Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
I want to welcome you wholeheartedly to the CG Jung Help Desk with a special topic for this Wednesday evening, which is inflation and possession. And this is a pretty cool topic because it's one of the key concepts of Jung. So Jung has some very important cornerstones of his psychology. That's just underlying premises that are like themes that pop up in all his concepts and all of his ideas in some way. And this idea of inflation and possession is centered around this idea that came up with Freud and psychoanalysis, that people are not necessarily the lord in their own house. So it is thought that what's happened in the psyche is in consciousness, and that is real, and I know everything, and everything that happens, I have a reason for, and it happens because I want to let it happen, and so on. And what psychoanalysis dealt with a lot is this idea of complexes, that there are like little, let's say, demons or devils in the psyche that act up and force the person to do certain things. And the goal of psychoanalysis and of therapy is then to loosen this knot and dampen down this autonomous psychological force. And Jung started with that because Jung was a psychoanalyst and he was a friend of Freud, and he really helped also to develop the theories. He went even deeper than that, than these complexes that are mostly based around trauma or undealt issues or shunned duty in life. And for him, in general, he said consciousness and the will and what we have and what we are is rather weak in the sense that, yes, we are conscious and we can decide what to do and what not to do, but it runs on batteries that are not so big. This means if we force ourselves to do something and we have to invest in it mentally, we tire very easily. And the perfect example is in school, or when you have to sit there, or in a meeting for all those people who are working, when you sit in a meeting and it's really not that interesting and it does not end, but you have to force yourself to listen to it, you come out of it and it feels like you run a marathon. You're just completely exhausted. And also when you come home and you work a lot with your mind, so you are in front of the PC the whole working day and your body did not do anything, but you feel completely exhausted. And he said, yeah, we have this capacity to really direct our attention and direct our will and actions and thoughts into certain directions, but we can only do that for a limited time. What society does with the institutions and with education is to foster this capacity to willfully do things for extended periods of times. When you have small children, they are very, let's say, unfocused, but through school and growing up, they can then learn to concentrate on certain topics, to pick them up better, and to perform basically tasks. When you work, this is basically what you do the whole day. You perform different tasks and you focus on them. Of course, you get routine and then it's not so taxing anymore. But every time you do something new or done something extremely boring, you have to expand this mental capacity. And Jung had this energetic model of the psyche, that everything that's happening in the psyche has an energy running behind it, which he called libido. And there's already this slightly rift between Jung and psychoanalysis, because in psychoanalysis, and let's say in colloquial language, libido is always something sexual, that's a sexual drive. And Jung said, no, it's more than that, it's more complex than that. He's characterized it more like a life force. So things are happening because of libido. But it's just an energetic metaphor where he said, okay, it helps to understand how he saw the psyche. And he said, ego and consciousness, which is around the ego being the I in German, das Ich, what one is and knows about oneself, it has this libido as like spare change, like a little bit of money that you can do with what you want. But this pales in comparison to what kind of libido is in the back of the psyche and the unconscious of all the things that are happening, involuntary, unconscious. So a little bit like your body, you're constantly breathing, your constantly heart is pumping, your liver is working, your intestines are processing food and so on. They all do it by themselves. You don't really have to do it consciously. If you would try to breathe consciously, you would also exhaust pretty easily. He saw the ego and the consciousness being overwhelmed by the unconscious in certain situations. For example, when you have complexes, then the unconscious starts to act out and being very forceful, being full of libido to force the person to do certain things. And it is this loss of will and consciousness which is characteristic for inflation and possession. And to describe the symptoms, I picked out some quotes to give a good feeling what he meant by that when he talked about inflation and possession. And I quote, "It seizes hold of the psyche with a kind of primeval force and compels it to transgress the bounds of humanity. It causes exaggeration, a puffed-up attitude, inflation, loss of free will, delusion and enthusiasm in good and evil alike." And further, "An inflated consciousness is always egocentric and conscious of nothing but its own existence. It is incapable of learning from the past, incapable of understanding contemporary events, and incapable of drawing right conclusions about the future. It is hypnotized by itself and therefore cannot be argued with. Also, inferiority feelings are typical characteristics of inflation. Sensitiveness is a sure sign of presence of inferiority." So it is this being sensitive, being unconscious, but also being extremely pushy, like pushing yourself on other people, forcing one's own morals onto other people, are this signs and symptoms of inflation and possession. And under these terms hide a lot of different causes, what can cause in inflation or possession, because some are just how the structure is, and some are really interesting and complex. So his first idea of inflation and where it comes from is just built into the system of consciousness. So consciousness itself is limited and it builds through life, ideally. So it's the extension of the things you can do voluntarily, the things that you know, the things you have experienced. But it's also at the same time all you can map of the world. So it's basically everything you can see of the world that you can easily give the impression that it is actually the world, because it's easy to say, everything I see is everything there is. And it is similar in that regard to this Dunning-Kruger effect, if it's known, that people can be so incompetent in something that they are unable to really evaluate what real competence looks like. So they think they are competent because they have no idea what competence looks like, but they know something about something and they think, that's all you need to know and that's enough. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, and it's pretty famous in popular psychology and I guess on Facebook. And it is this idea that consciousness does not really need to know that it's limited, that it does not know things, because the opposite of consciousness is the unconscious, which is everything that is not known, not integrated into consciousness. So basically everything in the world. And it's possible that by just assuming that everything that you know, so then having no humility to expect that this is all there is and there's nothing else to know and everything else is basically a distraction or not true, gives one this puffed up, inflated attitude. It's then arrogance, hubris. And it's this inability to distinguish between what is still out there to know. You're trapped in this Dunning-Kruger effect. It comes back to the quote that I read regarding the consciousness being reflected to itself. It's like looking in a lot of mirrors. The space might look enormous, but in reality, it's very, very small and very, very limited. And it's a little bit like driving with dirty windshields. you don't see the world, but it does not mean that it's not there and that it cannot hurt you. And he has this term of inflation for it, because it starts then to make the psychology of the person very abstract. It's like a theory. It's abstract in the sense that it's removed from complexity. It's a can be also a rather complex theory, but the theory, it's always removed, ethereal, up in the air, removed from all the nitty-gritty details and from the real world. So for him, it's really this rising up, rootless into the air, and being up there where everything is in a pie in the sky, castle in the sky situation, which is in turn, again, like driving with dirty windshields, full speed. You will hit something at a certain point. You just don't know it in time. And this is just a built-in problem into consciousness. As when consciousness becomes bigger, your field that you can view gets bigger and the things you can do. And it's very easy to think, okay, now I have this final insight. Now I know these final things. I can do these final things. That's not much more. But it does not matter the topic or the area you want to specialize in. It goes always deeper, 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 deeper. So this is one source of inflation. One source of possession is archetypes. So what Jung is pretty famous for is this idea of the archetypes, which are in the collective unconscious part of the psyche. He saw different layers in the psyche. And the lowest one is the collective psychology, which you have in common with all the human beings that exist right now, and also very likely all the human beings that will ever exist, and the ones who existed in the past, and even animals. So you can, for example, understand dogs way better than lizards or insects. Yeah, it's easier to sympathize because we are similar to them. The idea of collective consciousness is similar to human nature and also evolutionary biology, which was not a field back then, but Jung with his theories predicted it, let's say, already laid some foundation there. So archetypes are patterns of behavior. So a little bit like instincts that are already built into the system of the psychology when you're born, that are there a priori, but more complex in the sense that you can see it in animals, that they have very complex mating behavior, that they can build a nest or do a dance, or when salmons go down the stream until they hit the ocean, where they then become pregnant, and then they go up the river again, back to the original point. So this is a pattern of behavior. This is, for Jung, an archetype. But he saw an archetype even more than in human beings, at least, because that's what we know. It's manifests itself in symbols and occurrences in the internal psychological sphere. And this is then mapped in cultural products like religion, spirituality, and so on. So when we have these stories of the Greek gods, in a sense, those are archetypal stories. Like Oedipus, he credits Freud with discovering the first archetype by the Oedipus complex. The man who wants to sleep with his own mother, which is not a really fitting name. It does not fit one-to-one the story of Oedipus. But it is this idea that you can hit this pattern of behavior and it takes over your life. So it's like an ancient structure coming alive that it's known for thousands of years and longer than that. And even in stories, it does not only have to be religious and mythology, but also fairy tales, or just books, movies that exist now. Everything that is popular is, in a sense, archetypal because it speaks to deep parts in our psychology. And this creates a situation where you have your life on rails. So it's not a consciously lived life in the sense that you are forming this, that you decide where you want to go and what to do and not to do, but rather it's this strong archetypal force of the archetype determining one's life, one's actions, one's thoughts. And an example for that would be love as an overwhelming archetypal force that brings people to do certain things that the normalized would not do when they fall in love with someone and when they're really interested in someone. It's then a kind of hypnosis taking over, and ego and the consciousness gets blinded and overwhelmed by the libido in this In this sense, it would be fitting, the psychoanalytic term of libido, overwhelming ego and consciousness, to bring the person to do certain things that are rather unusual for the person. And he sees the problem, of course, not in love. That's would be a wrong thing to see, but of course you can be overwhelmed and overpowered with the wrong love. You could be in love with somebody who's not, it's not reciprocal. So it's only one side pushing very hard and being like driven to certain things and not getting the signals and not stopping, which would be a very downside of this archetype, that it's can be lived out primitively. So normally what we have in culture, it's a way of integrating the archetypes of course in one's life to give guidance how to act in the situation. For example, if you want to meet a partner, you should act in a certain way. And if you cannot do it, it shows that you're not really sophisticated and you will not be successful, especially as a man. And it's this drivenness and blindness then to do certain things and be possessed by certain ideas and thoughts that can take over the life of a person. So then you have, for example, these people that have ideas of conspiracy theories, just as an example. There are many examples. But there's one British guy, I think he's John Irving or so on. He talked about how there are lizard people and they're killing small childs and so on. You can see in this imagery and the symbols that are created for him and his psychology that it's very likely archetypal, because the fear of the snake and the dragon is something that's inborn in human beings and expresses itself in that way. And he's obviously overwhelmed by it and losing control over his life, in the sense that he then tries to warn people about the lizard people that are taking over the world and that are sacrificing small children. The consciousness and the ego gets hypnotized to do certain things. The body is taken over by other forces, overwhelming, libido, strong forces that bring the person again to do something that it would normally not do. Jung has also another example for this overwhelming force, and it is about Nietzsche, because Jung was a huge fan of Nietzsche. He had a seminar which the written document is over 1,500 pages. It's about Zarathustra. It's not even about the whole book. It's only about three quarters. And they both were professors in Basel. Not at the same time. Nietzsche was already dead when Jung started there. But Jung always had a deep fascination for Nietzsche. And he said the reason that Nietzsche was so megamaniacal was the archetypes and this creative spirit coming up, the spirit of the time. And Nietzsche recognized that to a certain degree. But of course, he followed it and wrote the things he did, but he had a miserable life, because that's a problem with an archetype. It's an archetypal, archaic, impersonal force that does not care about the individual person. It's overwhelming. One's life is on rails, and one does not decide one's own fate. And a typical example from psychoanalysis would be this identification with a heavenly child, so that people are still mentally captivated by being an infantile state, which Jung characterized with this archetype of the child, where people identify with that, with the archetype of being a child, being childlike, not growing up. So what psychoanalysis is mostly dealing with is getting people out of the basement of their parents and to be removed from the psychological field of the family unit. And he saw that really as the identification with the heavenly child, where people can think that these impersonal forces are them, that they even worship it in a sense. And he sees that easier identifiable with, for example, emotions and affects. So in emotion, you already have this word component of motion, of things moving. And you can be moved by love, but also by anger, by hate. And this is, I think, the closest example that everybody knows, that you can become so angry, so lustful, that you then do things that leave one in wonder, why have these been done? And this is psychological forces, again, overwhelming consciousness and having their own way. And another concept Jung talked about is this of the anima and animus, which is respective other sexual part within one's psyche. So he characterized two basic principles in the psyche of people, and all people have them just in different degrees. And one is the one of Logos, and the other one is Eros. Logos being the separating factor and Eros being the combining factor. So he said in the psyche, if you look deep enough, it's things are separating or things are coming together. And he characterizes that we have this difference between male and female by being either a little bit more on the Logos side or a little bit more on the Eros side. And if you're a man, then you're more on the Logos side, he says. And if you're female, then you're more on the Eros side. But of course, you have a whole psychology. You have both parts. You feel at home in one part, but the other part is still there. So what people then explore and encounter in their life is then the other part. And this is often characterized or more manifested in form of a figure. And there's then the anima figure for the man, or the animus figure, or figures even for women. And these he credits with a lot of influence. So especially when you're interested, for example, in a partner, chances are very high that the person that you selected, in a sense, unconsciously, is corresponding to this internal image you have of the other part within your psyche, which is not so known for you. So that as a man, the woman you're interested in is very likely corresponding to your anima image, to the female image that you have already in your psychology, the missing part of you. And Jung even calls this then the soul image. So it's a step to completion to experience that part and get in contact with that part and build a relationship with that part. But of course, these forces can be overwhelming, and man can be anima possessed and women can be animus possessed. And for anima possession, Jung sees this characteristic that there are certain men out there that are extremely driven. They just venture the world, they start companies, they are incredibly businesslike, but they are, again, they're driven. It's not their little consciousness, libido, that they have, the little spare change that they use, but rather something is acting through them, and it's their anima, and they are pushed by it. So I personally know one guy who is just being driven completely from inside. Something is pushing. He can't sit still. He constantly has to meet new people. He constantly has to travel the world. And I would not wonder if he's really anima possessed in that sense. But also, if you are like a man, like sleeping around a lot and just falling in love with one woman after the other, it's very likely that you're rather, or Jung at least, so invested in looking for that anima everywhere in the world that of course you cannot find your image that you have inside, outside. You're encountering real people. So in the beginning, it's very easy to ignore that you're dealing with real people, but the more time you spend with them, the more you find out that there's a disconnect between this image and the real person. So then moving on goes. Or people that don't find a partner or even don't want a partner, because for Jung and psychoanalysis, they are still in love with their mother and they're still this small child. And they don't want to have a real relationship with a real woman. So these are examples for anima possession. Animus possession is like a switch around that. Ah, I forgot something about anima possession. Anima possession makes men extremely moody. So uncontrolled emotions and sentiments, like negative moodiness, depression, but also extreme anger. So Jung credits the development of human culture with the ability to keep the anima of man in check, for example, through politeness and contracts and rules that do not create the situation that then man become anima possessed and start hurting people. At least that's Jung's theory and one of the theories regarding how humanity and culture develop. For women and animus possession, is of course, is again, looking for the animus in the outside world. So just moving around a lot, let's say. But for women, it's not moodiness, but rather it's opinions. To have opinions that come out of nowhere and be completely possessed by certain thoughts. He credits that women then have very strong ideas what other people should do and are then very concerned about the lives of others and how they should live it. One, my very first example I encountered just with the term animus possession came from John Peterson, who had this interview in Channel 4 with Kathy Newman. She was very aggressive and opinionated, and she was just trying to tear apart his argumentations and bring in anecdotes and everything. He later characterized this as typical animus possession. And he said, people who act like this, anima possessed or animus possessed, it's not only that they act like this in the outside, but also inside of them, they are being torn apart by the animus, or they're being ridiculed by the anima. And he calls again this like a veil being in front of one's eyes that disturbs what one sees and experiences. And there's always the forces again in the background that are pushing people in certain directions. So he says consciousness can be in the unconscious, which is a weird mental concept to accept. But consciousness is there, but it's blind. It's not really seeing the real world, but it rather it's filtered through something else. It can be the anima or the animus, and it can be emotions and affects, and it can be complexes, or it can be just the limitation of consciousness itself. And one of the biggest problems that he characterized for the modern world is this of mass psychosis, that you have people in groups, and he was very critical of groups in the sense that he said you can have 10 smart people, but put it in a group, then they're pretty dumb. As you can talk to a single person easily, you can even make to 2, 3, but the more people you have in a group, the harder it is to talk with someone. And the harder it is to, let's say, have useful discussion. When you're in a concert, you have the incredibly smart people there and capable people, but all they can do to interact with the artist on the stage is saying yay or boo. So it's very reduced bandwidth of capabilities what you can do to interact. And he said, when you're in a group, the level of consciousness lowers and becomes a little bit more primitive in the psychology. And he says, now in the modern world, we have huge groups. We have millions of people in states, in organizations, and in countries and continents and everywhere. And you can see it sometimes when the group gets into panic. It's just then this real primal force. You hear about it regularly, that there are stampedes of people where people die because people get into panic. And we had it in Germany in 2009. It was the last love parade that happened. It was in Duisburg. And there was just tightly packed people, and they would not let the people in, but they blocked the end of a tunnel. And people tried to get out, and there was this narrow steps of stairs. And as soon as people saw, okay, you can go, they tried all to push there. But then people, because it got pushy, got into panic, and then the whole group panicked, and a lot of people died. Even one person dying is too much, but multiple people died. And is this then, again, you have some primal forces taking over groups. And he said, today, the problem is we are highly capable. So when he talks about today, it's 100 years ago. We are highly capable, and we are prone not to scarcity of material things, but rather of psychological things. And there's psychic epidemics causing people to act in primitive, archaic, even archetypal ways and unsophisticated manners is a danger. And this is especially true when you have people that he described as mana personalities. So mana, it comes more from hunter-gatherer societies, he calls it primitive societies, early societies, where you have people that have, we would say, certain charm, certain aura that can captivate people. So about Steve Jobs, for example, it was said he had this reality distortion field that when you would talk to him, he could completely convince you about certain things. And the people around him were so convinced that they then pulled out people out of his sphere, just that they can think, let's say, clearly again. And when you have cult leaders, so people who are leading a group of people, very often to apocalyptic scenarios or mass suicide, he describes that as mana personalities, that they're captivating because they in turn are a vessel for archetypal forces, which then corresponds to the archetypal experiences that people have inside of them. And so a lot of archetypal stuff being activated between people, creating this mana personality that people are hypnotized those. And so, for example, Hitler or any famous person that has an influence, an interpersonal influence on people like that, that they are, in a sense, a vessel. They don't live their individual life. They live something else from the very primitive part of psychology, ancient part. But of course, then make slaves out of both. And this circle to break is hard because your own psychology then forces you again to do things and you are just your small consciousness and ego. So this is where one famous quote comes from him, where he says, people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. So the idea is already there. And people think, oh, that's my idea. But no, it's when you identify with the idea and think, oh yeah, I came up with that. No, something inside you came up with it and you think it's yours. It's at the blindness of consciousness. And another famous quote of his is, until you make the unconscious conscious, you will live blindly and will call it fate. And this is then this idea of archetypes and pattern of behavior that force you onto these rails and drive you along, and you're not aware of it. So there's a certain progression for all those different phenomena and, let's say, sources of inflation and possession, how it starts and develops. And for him, the first part is a fascination. So there's something that is really intriguing. You have an intriguing idea, thought, emotion that grips you, and you become very fascinated with that. Let's say you suddenly become very fascinated with lizard people. And this is already that your consciousness becomes aligned to this and this then and this mana circle of the idea of the person that draws your thoughts and your actions. So it's, again, a little bit like love, that you are really, really interested in someone or something. The problem is when it becomes pathological. So when it starts hindering one's normal life or normal actions and normal self-determination in life. This he then calls a disintegration. So ego and consciousness is supposed to be in the driver's seat, but suddenly something else is in the seat and taking over. So the function of consciousness is not really being fulfilled anymore. It's a disintegration of the structures that are there that normally are supposed to keep it running. Like in a country, you have government, institutions, and so on, all the structures and laws that are there to make normal living possible, as good as possible. Depends on the country, of course, but that's normally the intention, to keep things safe and running and smooth, as smooth as possible again. And a disintegration would be that suddenly certain laws fail, certain institutions fail. So people become more and more consumed by an idea or an emotion or a person. And they dissolve and don't live a self-determined life anymore. And the flip side, and which makes it so attractive for Jung, is this power aspect that then comes, because suddenly you're not this small person anymore, which has a hard time to concentrate on something, that has a hard time to adjust to things and so on, but rather now you're driven by this incredibly libido resources from the collective unconscious, and you feel this incredibly power surge. You have endless energy to do something suddenly. So it's really pervasive, and it's understandable why it would someone take over. Oh, it's fascinating, and I don't have to do anything, and or rather, I think that's me, and I have now endless energy to do certain things. But coming back to the symptoms, that makes one extremely sensitive when one is pointed out. It's an inflation, it's arrogance, it's hubris, it's living beyond good and evil with huge enthusiasm, exaggeration, pushing yourself on other people with morals, with ideas. So constant meddling, it's really not a good way to live. And people then, of course, burn out because it's like a car. Yeah, you can drive your car 200, 250, depends on the car, but you can't do it the whole time. So because the forces aren't personal, they don't care about the small limited body that you have in your now and in your life. It will burn the body out and it will burn the psyche out through this possession. And he has this example with Nietzsche that got burned out by it. And symbolically and chemically, this is described with the lion that suddenly comes. He noted that because he was a psychotherapist, he had a lot of patients and he saw their development, of course. And he noted when people were depressed, depression is this complete lack of energy. So you have no libido, you have no spare change to do anything. And the rest of the psyche does not really help. So something, the energy is still there and it's doing something, but it's not helping you to live your normal life and you cannot really control it. When people come out of that and they have this sudden surge of energy from all those archetypal, primal, primitive forces, they become huge egoists and arrogant and megalomaniac because they are now full of energy. And this is a common thing that he saw that then people have to deal with. So it's the exact flip side from no energy to all the energy. And it's nice to have all the energy, but at a certain point you burn out. So that has to be looked out for. And this brings us to the point, okay, how to break this, how to not become victim of this situation and phenomena that can happen. The first thing is already humility, to be aware that there's more outside that one knows or can do, and to have basically an awareness that something like this can happen. So what Jung did with his patients, he explained the psyche to him according to his ideas and theories. And the cornerstone, as I said, is this idea of the impersonal force that takes over. So it's necessary to separate, so like, okay, anger is happening within me, or lust, or hate, or whatever, but that's not me. Like, I'm being pulled along, but it's something outside of me that I can distance from. So when you, for example, have mindfulness training, don't know if somebody has done it before, it's really this idea from, okay, you have a thought, you have a very strong emotion, but it's like clouds in the sky that will pass if you wait. So don't get pulled along, just wait and watch and realize it's not everything that's happening in you is really you, but rather can be something separated. So he even, I have a quote for this, explained it like this, that what people should do with their consciousness again. Why has this idea taken possession of me? What does it mean in regard to myself? A modest doubt like this can save us falling headfirst into the idea and vanish forever. So stepping back, reflecting, and asking yourself, okay, yeah, where does this fascination come from? Why I am so interested in meeting, let's say, new girls, but only for the first week or the first month or only the first 2 years, to realize, okay, there is something happening which is, let's say, out of the ordinary and may not be in my best own interest. And for Jung, all these experiences, they tell you something about yourself. Since finding a partner and finding someone attractive, half of the world is the other sex. But one is interested in very specific people. So, okay, why these people? And of course, you can also be always interested in the wrong persons. And this interest is also one part of himself. It's not like, oh, they're really interesting. Yeah, they're really interesting for me. Why are they interesting for me? Where is this fascination coming from? And then having the humility to accept, okay, yeah, I might be really interested in things for the wrong reasons, or I might not even know the reasons. It might not be integrated in that way. Especially, as said, when there are unfitting reactions, when you are extremely, have strong emotions suddenly about someone or a fact or a thing that happened, which is out of the normal control. This was his first investigation regarding complexes, when people had complexes, to see, okay, yeah, where are they sensitive? Where do they have, you mention a situation or a word and people go off the rails. For example, you mention money and then people become very agitated and can't stop talking about it. And it's like somebody is playing a script, like a recording. You're not talking to the person anymore. You're just talking to this emotion or trying to handle this emotion. And he said the problem that we have today, let's say culturally, is that we situate now everything as a psyche. So in the past, it was situated outside of the psyche, that, oh, this river or this tree, there's a spirit, there are forces, and they had an outside place. And people know, and you can see this in Greek literature, that they say, I got possessed by Ares, I got possessed by Aphrodite, or Apollo granted me strength. So it's already the separation step where you say, okay, there's some forces outside of me that influence my life. This is a little bit more sophisticated what we have today, which is like, oh no, the world outside, it's materialistic, it's dead, which is true. But the view of there is something outside was psychological, a psychological projection. And at least all these spirits, let's say, had a place. But now they're not outside anymore for Jung. We have them inside, which does not mean they are gone. It's just that they're not aware of them. So the consciousness of these ideas and of those forces are missing. So it has to be relearned through psychology that this exists. And he credits psychology with that, with the demise of religion and these cultural structures that help people normally to manage their psyche and their unconscious, now missing and has to be rediscovered through psychology, which is the fitting terminology and the interest of the time. The interest in psychology is very, very big. That's the reason why we now are all here together. Because we are very interested in psychology, because it's, we say, yeah, there is something and I want to learn more and I want to learn more about myself. So this is also the goal of Jung's life work, to make people aware and, let's say, translate the old knowledge from the past into modern terms and make it understandable for the modern mind. Because he said people are interested. They want reasons. They want to understand. It's not enough to have a dogma, to believe it. People want to understand, yeah, why is this? And this is how we have the youngest science, which is psychology, which is not that old, because in the past there was no necessity for that. So that would conclude my presentation in regards to inflation and possession. And I tried to collect all the examples that I could find for this. And I hope you're now able to understand and recognize. I want to thank you all, and I hope you enjoyed it. And this would be then the conclusion of the first part, and now comes the second part, which is a talky-talky part where we all talk together. So thanks for the attention.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Help Desk. Also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.